Welcome to episode 15 of the Field Day podcast, brought to you by the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. My name is Jordan Haywisher, Director of Water Quality and Research for the Ohio Farm Bureau. Today we're going to go into the animal world, going into the veterinarian world, and talking to Dr. Leah Dorman from Fibro Animal Health. So we kind of take a different direction from water quality and nutrient management and manure and anything else we've talked about. And so we have a good talk with Dr. Dorman, who happened to be the person who hired me on at Farm Bureau. So I think you'll see that this is a little bit longer of a podcast because we have a little bit more of a personal connection. And I hope you get some information about kind of the status that is the veterinarian world. Enjoy. All right, we'll get started here. So tell me who you are, where'd you come from, where you been, all that good stuff.
I'm Dr. Leah Dorman. And where did I come from? I came from Farm Bureau most recently. No, I'm from Northwest Ohio, but I live in Central Ohio. And I work for Fibro Animal Health. And I do communications of all things, even though I'm a veterinarian. So I do a lot of science communications, both internally, but also with external audiences, especially consumers. And my title is Director of Food Integrity and Consumer Engagement.
That doesn't sound like a corporate title at all. I mean, coming from someone who is a trained veterinarian, you know. So what's Fibro Animal Health? Like, give me like the rundown of what that group does.
Sure. Fibro is a global animal health company. We do a variety of different things. We're probably most well known for nutritional specialty products and minerals. So we do a lot of feed additives, many of which are, like I say, the minerals. So making sure that animals have that balance of vitamins and minerals, but then in the premix side, but then we also do nutritional specialty products. And those are natural products that either help support gut health or support the immune system. They do a variety of different things. So that's kind of the non-medicated side. And then we also do medicated feed additives. So those are medications that get added to feed for livestock. We also do vaccines, mainly autogenous vaccines here in the United States, but globally we also have commercial vaccines.
Quick glossary.
What is an autogenous vaccine? Yeah, I saw the look on your face and I'm like, I got it.
For the audience, I obviously know it and I can spell it and use it in a sentence, but like it's for the audience.
I'm not sure I can
actually
spell it.
I can't do any of those things, but what is autogenous?
An autogenous vaccine basically is when your veterinarian comes to the farm, they take samples of what's going on, right? So they're going to take samples that get sent to our lab. We culture it up, we grow it, we look at it, we look at kind of that DNA fingerprint, decide what are the best samples, what are the best bacteria to use. And it may be a combination of several bacteria, it could be viruses as well, depending on what situation we're talking about. And then we make a vaccine that is specific
to that farm.
And it actually can only be used on that farm with some additional paperwork. If there are kind of a situation where, you know, there are other farms in that area at risk, if, you know, the state veterinarian again approves as well, there can be some paperwork done that it can be shared with some other adjacent farms too that are connected.
Is that a way to like appease regulation essentially? Because usually stuff goes to like a system, or is it something different?
Yeah, no, these are regulated as well. And that's really in part why it only goes to that specific farm.
That's cool.
That farm.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as we push more and more, and we'll get into it, but as we push more and more into, not broad applying, medicines, I'm sure it's nice to have that specific prescription for that specific strain or whatever it
Absolutely. Is. It's just another tool that we can use to keep animals healthy. So those are kind of our main buckets, is medicated feed additives, vaccines, nutritional specialty products, and mineral nutrition. So we really focus on the food animal world. So our main species that we do in the U.S. and globally is poultry, swine, dairy and beef cattle, and aquaculture.
Aquaculture, we'll get into that. So as the communications role, you know, what are the main things that you're tasked with in terms of getting the talking points and the messages out of your company?
Just say, Leah, what the heck do you do?
Pretty much. So when you're flying and you're flying all over the world and they see somebody come in with like some bedazzled like country shirt on and some boots,
Okay. I don't have the bedazzled shirt, but I definitely have some pretty wild boots.
Some pink boots. And they're like, I didn't know the rodeo was going to Phoenix. So what do they say to you? Like, what do you do? What's your pitch?
Yeah. Yeah. So a couple things. One, if I feel like talking, because, you know, sometimes you get somebody who doesn't want to talk, or sometimes I just don't want to talk. But, you know, if I feel like talking, there's times when literally I'll sit down and I'll look at my watch and go, hey, if things run on time, I'm going to, you know, I'll be home in time to feed livestock with my family. And it's so funny to see looks on their faces, especially if I'm like in a business suit. They'll look at me like, what? You have livestock? You know, what do you have? And then I start to tell them, hey, we raise cattle and some meat goats, and I'm a veterinarian too. And they're like, oh, really? Now, what do you suppose the first thing they begin to tell me?
Something about their dietary choices. They're like,
no.
I do non-GMO or organic.
No, not first. First, when they hear I'm a veterinarian, because they don't know that really I focus on more the food animal, the agricultural side, and they don't really know that I work more on the food side. So they start talking. I get every cat and dog story known to mankind, which can be really fun and interesting. I'm okay with that. Except I haven't practiced companion animal medicine other than on my own and, you know, on some family and friends for a really, really long time. And so I get every cat and dog story known to mankind. And so I've decided the next time somebody asks me what I do, rather than say I'm a veterinarian, I'm going to say I'm a proctologist.
Yeah, I mean, because there's not a lot of follow-ups from there.
Well, I'm hoping, but my fear is that I will hear stories that I really don't want to. But then my second issue is, hey, would you look at this?
Yeah, I don't know if there's enough room in the plane for that to really get the,
I hope not.
To get the flashlight out or the miner's helmet or whatever they have to wear to do that.
No, but seriously, Jordan, I do, after they kind of get a feel for what I do, and because I do both internal communications for Fibro Animal Health, but I also do external communications. So I do, I work a lot with the organizations we're members of. So whether it's National Chicken Council, National Pork Board, you know, those kinds of groups, you know, the dairy groups, et cetera. I also communicate directly with consumers. And so you can check that out at exploreanimalhealth.org. So I'm going to repeat that. That's my one plug, exploreanimalhealth.org, or follow me on Ask Dr. Dorman. And that's really the consumer outreach, just to answer people's questions about food and agriculture, because a lot of times, just like on the plane, they don't think of a farmer wearing a business suit. And so they often ask questions about what we do or the food that they eat. The most common question that I get usually, and especially if it's another lady that's a mom like me, I also hear questions about antibiotics. That's usually the first one when they hear I'm a veterinarian, I raise cattle and goats. And then the second one is hormones. They ask me about hormones. So those are kind of the first two questions they typically ask me.
Yeah, so let's go down that road. So antibiotics obviously have taken a life of their own over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. You have, you know, resistance stories, you have overuse stories, or you have just maybe misinformation about what's going on. I think it's something that's always, you know, close to my heart in terms of animal care and stuff. I grew up on a pig farm. And so those two topics are always the ones I probably get into the most arguments, besides maybe GMOs, when I'm talking to my friends that aren't, you know, farm kids. Give me the lay of the land on the current status of antibiotic use in you're calling them food animals?
Yeah, I call them food animals.
Food animals,
livestock, yep. You know, whatever you want to call them. But first of all, I'm going to give you a hard time, Jordan. Stop having arguments.
Well,
it's not an argument. Have a nice conversation, and it's okay to agree to disagree, but you can have a nice conversation without having to try and, as I always say, punch him in the throat with science.
It may come later in the evening sometimes. But yes, good conversations, persuasive conversations are had.
And it doesn't even have to be persuasive. You know, to me, the whole goal is just have a nice conversation, because quite frankly, the people asking probably have never met a farmer, never met somebody who's involved on the production side of food, meat, milk, and eggs mainly. And so what a wonderful opportunity can't talk. What a wonderful opportunity to just answer the question simply, openly, honestly that they have. So that's going to be my pointer for you. Don't have an argument. Don't get defensive. And I know it's hard. Yeah. I do, you know.
Just general, like, advice for my whole life. Just like, it has nothing to do with just a specific conversation. Just don't get defensive. Don't be so sensitive.
And I'll tell you, before I get to the antibiotics question, you know, I fell in that same role. And honestly, Farm Bureau really helped train me. I work really closely, and I did even here at Farm Bureau with Center for Food Integrity, because they really looked at what builds trust, especially with consumer, what builds trust. And it's not facts and science. It's not skills and ability. It's about shared values. So what values, you know, if they're saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you feed all these livestock, you just pour these antibiotics to them. And, you know, what's their fear? What's their fear? What is their value? Mm-hmm. And there's a good chance they probably value food safety. They want to make sure that what they're feeding their family is safe, that it's nutritional. It could mean that maybe they're concerned about animal care. You know, do you have that many sick animals? You know, kind of attitude. And I understand they don't know. And they've certainly heard lots of negative stuff about agriculture out there. So I always take every conversation as an opportunity to make a really positive impression for agriculture in general. So
yeah,
that's my soapbox, right?
No, that's great. I mean, because in the end, the goal is the same for both sides, right? Like, they just want to consume, they want to produce and consume, you know, healthy, safe, you know, food, essentially. So it's just a matter of meeting in that to that point that gets to that same location.
It is. They want to be comfortable. They want to know that it's okay to eat what they're eating. And so that's where we can just give them ability. We can give them a little more information, you know, but lead with those values. Lead with, hey, you know, I get it. You know, you're concerned about food safety. Gosh, we are too. As a matter of fact, that's why we, you know, whatever the sentence is. And in the case of antibiotics, you know, there are several things in place to be sure that even when animals do need to be treated with antibiotics, there are several things in place to make sure that that food is still safe for you to feed your family.
Yeah, so I guess let's go down that, you know, pathway of like, what's the most general time antibiotics are applied, and then what are those parameters after there is an application of antibiotics to an animal?
Yeah, great question. And that is one of the topics that I think amazes consumers the most. You know, we're really using antibiotics for prevention, control, and then also treatment of disease. And so prevention, obviously, is when those animals are at high risk for disease and the factors are right where they're going to be at high risk. And the veterinarian says, hey, because they're at such high risk at this time, we need to give them some antibiotics. Even before anybody in the group, herd, flock, is showing signs of disease, that's prevention. Prophylaxis is the fancy word for it. And then there's control, and control is also called metaphylaxis. And control is really about, all right, you've got maybe one or two, or you've got a few showing some early signs of disease. Gosh, they're in this group. There's a really high likelihood those animals are going
to
affect affect the ones nearby. And so rather than allow that to rip through the entire herd, whether it's three animals or, you know, whether it's 3 million, you know, you want to protect the rest of those herd, that rest of that herd or flock in close proximity. And so we can administer antibiotics for control. And again, we're talking about bacterial diseases here when we're talking about antibiotics. And then the third way is treatment. So those animals are sick. And honestly, if animals are sick, you know, it's our role, both as a veterinarian, but also as a farmer, to go ahead and treat that animal in order to prevent the suffering and the potential pain that comes along with that disease. It's just simply the right thing to do.
Yeah. And so say if an animal was treated, what's like, so like say I have a chicken, which I never would, but I have a chicken and that chicken, a vet has administered some antibiotics, and say that's a chicken that is destined for meat production.
The food system.
What goes into place between the vet giving that chicken antibiotics, to when it could potentially go into the food system?
Okay, I'm going to back up even just a little bit further than that. And I like that question because that's an important piece to bring out. So the first thing that we do is farmers and veterinarians are required by law to follow something called the withdrawal time. So as we give that animal medication, there is a time listed on that medication that says this animal needs to be kept out of the food system or the animal's product, you know, milk, eggs, whatever. It says they have to stay out of the food system for X amount of time. Sometimes that's days, you know, if it's a milk, sometimes it's hours. It just depends on what the drug is and what the species is. But that is listed right on the label of that medication. So we are required to follow that one. So it's the time, withdrawal time is the time that animal stays out of the food system after we've ended treating that animal with antibiotics until they can go into that food system. So that's the first thing. But backing up just a little further, as the drug sponsor and obviously Fiber Animal Health, we do make some antibiotics. We make some other medicated feed additives. And so we have to put a withdrawal on those. It could be zero, depending on the medication. That just simply doesn't get into the meat, milk, or eggs. Other things, again, can be up to days long. So part of what we have to do when we submit that medication for approval to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, part of that is those trials to say, okay, not only is this drug safe and effective for the animal at such and such a dose and all the different species, we provide all the studies, all that information, then we also have to say, oh, and by the way, here's all the studies and trials that say this is when that medication is out of this animal system and this food is safe to eat.
Yeah, and that's probably even still, I mean, I have a little bit of a research background in plants, but I would assume there's still even some safety nets involved with that number, right? And they usually don't, I would assume they don't put it up to the very minute, you know, that's that, and maybe it's not, I'm not going to speak for your company, but I know like for fertilizer trials, you know, there's still a safety range there that's pretty comfortable in case there is, a close call in terms of how
absolutely
close it comes to that date. So
yeah, absolutely. And then there's a check and balance on the other side. And so that the check and balance part is that, you know, the food companies or the farm itself is doing testing many times. But then USDA, when we're talking about meat, is also in the plant doing routine testing as that sort of check and balance to be sure that there are no unsafe residues in our meat, milk, and eggs.
Yeah, so when people make a statement in terms of, oh, I don't want something that was raised with antibiotics, if the farmer and the meat producer or whoever is following the law, I mean, it's not just a guideline, it's a law.
It's a law.
A federal law, I think. Mm-hmm. That means that there's not a way of accessing whatever antibiotics had been put into that animal through its lifetime. So I think that's just an interesting point. Even though our audience is primarily, ag related, I think it's a good point to stress that there are guidelines in place if there is something that's been administered to an animal.
Absolutely. And not only guidelines, but requirements. And
yeah.
And there's confusion. There's confusion swirling, no doubt about this. And in part, it's in part our own fault, right? Because we don't necessarily always communicate very well or in a way that really resonates with the consumer. But I think the second issue is that our food labeling, the way we label food, even in the grocery store, has confused consumers. And I've told this story many times, but I had a conversation, and it was a Farm Bureau event, and I was sitting there with another farmer, and we're sitting around the table and we're having lunch, and the topic of antibiotics came up, and there was just a consumer sitting there, and we were kind of quote practicing our newfound skills after training, right? And this lady, again, no farming background, no connection to agriculture, began to ask some questions about antibiotics, and one of the other farmers, who also raises a fair amount of cattle and hogs, looked at her and said, well, what do you think about farmers using antibiotics? And she said, well, I'm okay with it. I'm okay. And I understand animals get sick. You need to treat them. You know, I'm okay with it, but I guess I'm okay with antibiotics being in my food. And yeah, so I saw your face, and so I had that kind of brief internal seizure. And so I said to her, and I said, oh, I understand that you're probably concerned about making sure that the food you feed your family is safe. I completely get that. You know, we are gosh, as a veterinarian, I raise even, and a farmer, I raise some of my own food. And so I want you to understand there are several safeguards in place to be sure that after an animal is treated with antibiotics, that food is safe for you and your family to eat. And I explain withdrawal time and briefly, and I explain the testing kind of check and balance system. And she said, oh, I had no idea that was happening. And then I asked her, I said, help me understand, because I'm a little surprised by your response. Help me understand why you thought that. And she almost looked embarrassed to me, and she dropped her head a little bit and said, well, when I go to the grocery store, you know, I'm a middle income family, and I can't always afford to buy the antibiotic free meat. So I buy the meat that has the antibiotics in it.
Yeah, because it's implied, right? When they say raised without antibiotics, it just means, yeah, they maybe weren't treated with antibiotics, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's you know, free or not in or whatever.
Right.
It's kind of a wording.
That was totally my aha moment.
Yeah.
Because then now I understood why she thought there was antibiotics and everything else. And then she had this kind of mom guilt complex that, oh, I feel bad because I can't afford to feed my kids this labeled like that. And I said, now I get it. Thank you for sharing that. It totally was an aha moment for me. And I said, I hope you now understand that you pick whichever one you want. Both are safe to feed your family.
Yeah.
Feel comfortable and confident in that. And,
yeah.
You know, I had no suggestion. It's not that one is better than the other. You feed the one that is most comfortable for you and your family for whatever things you value.
Yeah, and that's ultimately, I mean, not to get too pie in the sky about it, but it's like that's ultimately a testament to our whole system, right, in the United States, where we have inspectors and we have checks and balances in place. Obviously, we like to not go off the rails on regulation one side or the other. But it's also, you know, nice to know, like, hey, we have the food security of having the backing of a USDA inspector in every, you know, plant and all that stuff to ensure that you can make those statements and ensure that when that lady makes that choice, that they're getting what is, you know, what is promised to them. So.
Yes. And I agree entirely. We do have one of the safest food supplies in the world, and we somewhat take that for granted.
Absolutely.
And now that I've been in several other countries around the world and seen some of the open sewer systems and the open restaurants, and, you know, I've learned to eat deep-fried foods in those locations just to be a little safe. I'm not a germaphobe.
Just prefer high temperatures.
But yeah, there are some places that are, you know, not so pretty and not so sanitary.
Yeah.
And so we've got it pretty good here as far as food safety. But I think, again, that's just something that we can help people understand a little bit more and be more comfortable and be more confident in the food that they're purchasing and feeding to their families.
Yeah. So speaking of that, the other thing that you had mentioned is hormones. So the H word for some people are like, oh, my God, everything's my kids are consuming hormones and they're, you know, milk is this and that. So, like, just give me, for my sanity, just like give me the rundown on, like, what's the status
what
of hormones in food production.
Yeah. So it always cracks me up when they find out I raise cattle and they find out that I have three girls. And the first thing they ask, you can imagine, is, oh my gosh, do you use hormones?
Like, I mean, I can't control the kids. I try. I mean, it's just going to happen.
I can't stop them. No. Do you use hormones when you're raising your cattle? And my answer is, yeah, I do. And they're like, wait a minute. But you have daughters. Why do you do that? You know, aren't you worried about early maturity? And I'm like, no, really, I'm not. And it's not really an issue. I said, if you really think about it, I said, first of all, I'm using the hormone and understand that it's, you know, it's an estrogen-like compound. It's estradiol, right? So, and it comes in this little silicon implant that looks almost like the top of a pencil eraser. And you basically put that in behind their ear, kind of between the skin and the cartilage, and it just stays there, and then it slowly releases. And like I say, it's an estrogen-like compound.
We're talking about the cows, right?
I'm talking about the cow.
Cows.
I'm not talking about
cows.
My kids. Yeah, cows.
Cows.
Cows, cows not kids. And so then I just explained kind of, you know, the process, what it is. And I said, the reason I do that, though, is so that I can use less resources in raising my cattle. And because I know that by doing that, I use less water and less feed, which means less acreage, less carbon footprint to raise that same animal to get it ready for market. So that's why I do it, is to conserve resources. But as far as the concern, you know, I understand, you know, you're concerned about making sure that the food is safe.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I'll say, do you eat cabbage? And they'll go, yeah, I like cabbage, or no, and then I'll pick another one. Do you eat cabbage? Yeah. And I said, you know, there's way more of that same type of hormone in a serving of cabbage than there is in hormone implanted
beef. Yeah.
And then they're just like, what? And I'm like, yeah, hormones are natural. And there's really not that much more of that similar type hormone in beef that was raised with that hormone. But as far as, you know, girls maturing earlier, coming into puberty earlier, it's true. They do. And they have, you know, now they come in maturity earlier than they did 50 years ago. That's true. I suspect that will continue to be the trend. And some of that is because of weight.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, let's face it, we're heavier today than we were 50 years ago. And quite honestly, the body knows when it has the ability to support a pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so until that body has enough weight that it can support a pregnancy, it will not turn that on.
Yeah.
And so as girls are heavier at a younger age, that gets turned on earlier. And so I said it's no different in cows. Honestly, if you have a really thin cow or another animal, that animal many times will not become pregnant. Why? Because their body knows that it doesn't have the reserves to support a pregnancy. And so it just simply doesn't come into heat. It doesn't cycle.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure like if you're talking to a lay person, there's like, I just asked about hormones in cows.
No, a lot of times they bring up,
yeah,
well, aren't you worried about, you know, early puberty and your kids?
Yeah.
And I'm like, great question.
Yeah.
No, but here's why.
Yeah. So what about hormones in milk, which is probably the more prevalent one, I think, in society, or was at some point, or the one that I think it's because, you know, kids ingest, you know, bovine milk, and like I think that's always the one that increases the attention on things. What about hormone in the milk supply? What's the general
opinion? You know, the main hormone we were using was, you know, a lot different. The RBST, bovine somatotropin, is the big long word, and really not as much use of that as there was. The sad part is even that milk, which is labeled as RBST free, if you read the fine print down at the bottom, it says, hey, because BST, the non-man-made or the natural BST that a cow has naturally, is there anyways.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, they can't tell the difference in lab tests. And so there's like a little disclaimer in the really teeny tiny print. If it has a BST free label, and I hate that label. You know, anything that says free, I'm like, can we say raised without BST? Because technically, just like hormone free, sorry, no,
they're
plants and animals can live without hormones. You know, no hormones added is fine, or raised without added hormones. Canada has it right when it comes to antibiotics. They use the phrase raised without antibiotics, which gives a much better picture of what it is than antibiotic free, because all our meat's safety.
Well, I mean, so. It's similar to me, like being more of a plant person. I get annoyed by the GMO free when there's not a GMO alternative.
Oh my god!
You know, because I understand if there is a GMO alternative crop, fine. Like you're just raising awareness of something that doesn't have it in there. But when it's something that doesn't have an actual, you know, GMO alternative, it really makes me mad.
I had this exact conversation 2 days ago from my Uber driver.
Yeah.
And he's like, so what do you think about organic? He didn't ask about organic. He asked about GMOs. And I said, well, we're grain farmers, and so we use some GMOs. And I said, mainly because, one, it allows us to use less pesticides. It allows us to have some drought tolerance when, you know, the weather doesn't cooperate with us. But then it also helps prevent diseases that we don't have to try and kill or take care of other ways. And so that really has helped us a number of years. And so if you explain it sort of like that, really simply, of what those benefits are, and he's like, oh, GMOs concern me. And, you know, a lot of times I'll ask questions as to why, but I remember saying, he's like, well, I see a lot of these non-GMO labels. And I said, and I laughed. I laughed. I couldn't help it. And I said, yeah, there's a lot of non-GMO labels. I said, but did you know that there's only 10?
Yeah.
There's only 10 plants that are approved as a GMO plant and available commercially. And he's like, 10? That's it?
Yeah.
And I go, yeah. So when you see that tomato that has a non-GMO label, I said, I always laugh. If you want to pay extra for that, you go.
Yeah.
But there aren't any tomatoes that are GMOs.
Yeah. Or they're ones that have been modified and they're growing with like
they're hybrids.
Yeah. Or they're growing with like the root stem of a potato plant. Like they actually do like funky stuff. And it's like you're cool with like grafts on, you know, apple trees and things like that, but you're not. You know, so whatever.
It makes me digress. Yeah. But it did. But
they are similar. They are like, you know, cousins in terms of just misinformation or not enough information about what the reality is. And I think the hormone one specifically is one that needs to be updated, you know, because I think everyone just says, oh, hormones, and maybe it's transferred a little bit to antibiotics. But I think people are in that same rut of 15, 20 years ago. And I just don't know if people understand what the current, you know, situation is with animal production.
I think that's true. And I think science is scary for a lot of people, which is why we shouldn't answer their questions with science. Mm-hmm. Believe me, that's like, you know, pull the knife out of my heart, okay? Because I like science. I'm sort of a nerd. Don't comment, Jordan. Just keep that to yourself. So that's hard not to answer with science, but we can't. We have to lead with those values. Now, once we've made the connection with the consumer at that values level, where can we agree? Where can we agree? We can agree on food safety. We can probably agree on animal care. We can probably agree on we want to be good to the environment. But focus on where you can agree, and then lots of times you can sort of follow that up with the science, but we can't lead with it, because if they don't trust us, they don't trust our science either.
Switching gears a little bit, so we talk about, you know, veterinarians and their roles in the system. I think it's under known or underutilized, I don't even know if utilize is the right word, but I think it doesn't get enough spotlight on a vet's role in just the whole food safety and food supply in the United States and around the world. You know, just give us a glimpse on what just the vet is involved with in terms of being a part of the safety of our food.
A number of different ways. So I'm like, you can see me cataloging right now. Well, the people listening can't, but so I think a number of different ways, you know, and some of those we talked about, you know, just making sure that medications, et cetera, that we're using on the farm, let's make sure those withdrawal times are being held to. So I think that's certainly one way, but just simply keeping animals healthy on the farm and helping farmers do that, I think is really key in having a healthy food supply as well. So, and you know, that comes, it's not just antibiotics, right? That's not even necessarily the first thing we grab. There are so many other tools in the toolbox. And just to name a few, you know, we want to make sure that the animals have appropriate housing and they have good ventilation. Sanitation is good, that biosecurity plans are in place so disease isn't coming in. We want to be sure they've got a vaccination program so that if disease does come in, there's some protection there. And nutrition is certainly important as well, to make sure they've got what they need and a balanced diet for their stage and of production as well as their age. So all of those things are really, really important. And I think that's one of the roles, is helping farmers do all of those things and have a plan. So that's more on the farm. But then after that, certainly there's roles for veterinarians in industry, you know, research, education.
Communication, right.
Communication for companies. So I have sort of an odd job, but a great one nonetheless. And then I think the other way is, especially on the food safety side, is it seems like the USDA constantly is looking for veterinarians to fill their public health veterinarian roles. So it's the folks that are, you know, working in those meat plants, or I suppose other plants as well, but the meat plants especially, making sure that there aren't issues of public health or food safety issues. So that's sort of their role in the plant, is monitoring, you know, what's going on at that plant from a food safety perspective.
Yeah, and so obviously some of that question was meant to be a little bit redundant, just to catalog all the things that we need, you know. I say large animal vets, but you say, you know, food animal or whatever. But, you know, we've heard from, you know, the college at Ohio State and other places that we just have an extreme shortage, at least regionally, and a shortage of animal vets for food production and all that whole system you just explained. So I just kind of wanted to highlight that, and maybe you can talk a little bit more, you know, about, you know, why that is, you know, why do we have such a shortage? Why aren't people going into, you know, this field? I mean, I know some of the answers. I mean, no, it's such a tough industry. I have family members that have been vets, and it's such a tough industry to just, you know, go to some of these farms and do what they need to do. But maybe you can expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's several reasons. And one is, being able to cover a large area. Now think about it, you know, one, if I'm a companion animal vet, I'm in the office, I'm not exposed to, you know, it's that comfort level, right? So I have a, you know, air conditioned in the summer, heated in the winter. And if I'm a food animal or a large animal vet, you know, I'm out there in the mud, the blood, and I was gonna say beer, but that seems wrong. I think that's a country song, the mud, the blood, and the beer. So I think that's some of it. It's hard work.
Yeah,
it's hard work.
You're like boxing out heifers and like trying to like figure how to like blood test this and that while you're in all that stuff. I mean, it's such a...
I have taken blood from a herd of dairy cows, and dairy cows are a little easier to work with than, you know, some of the other animals that aren't quite handled as often as dairy cattle. And I pull in blood, and it was 20 below. And my toes have never hurt so bad in all of my life. My hands swelled up. Yeah, I thought I was going to die. So it was hard. It's hard on you, physically even. And so I think that's probably a bit of a deterrent, recognizing that, especially, and now that I'm getting older, recognizing that, you know, I'm going to have shoulder surgery or whatever, just from, you know, palpating too many cows, et cetera. So, and getting kicked and those kinds of things that, you know, it's a bit more dangerous.
Yeah. And then you have, obviously, you know, the type of money it takes to get through, you know, a vet school after undergrad and all that stuff. I mean, you have such a hefty student debt bill, and then we're asking them to go, you know, be a large animal vet that maybe doesn't have that payback as when you have people who have companion animals coming into your centralized office that maybe have a little bit more income.
You can have an appointment every 15 minutes where if I have to drive 2 hours to one call, then somebody's going to have to pay for that, and that's going to be the farmer. And so it's hard for the farmer to be able to afford that type of service.
Yeah.
And then it's hard for the veterinarian to spend 2 hours of their day just driving to that particular farm. And so that's also hard to pencil out and make it work. And, you know, we do have a lot of veterinarians, especially the larger farms, that are on staff or oftentimes consult in multiple states. Yeah. And there are some laws and rules about some of that as well. So I think that's another one of the issues. And for me, and I'm just looking back at kind of my food animal practice days, you know, it was tough because, you know, there were times people would call you for advice and I wanted to help everyone. And so I'd try and help them through or get them through the weekends, you know, what I could, because, you know, I have laws and rules I have to live by to maintain my license. I would get them by if I could, without an emergency, you know, weekend trip charge and all those kinds of things. But then, you know, when it came time Monday morning to schedule that appointment, they'd call their, quote, regular veterinarian. And so, you know, it was really hard to sort of make that pencil out again from that, you know, veterinary perspective.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've got, you know, I've got seven goats, you know, I've got seven does or so at home, and it's hard. It's not like I'm going to call you out for a monthly herd check. It's not like you have regular business from me. It's more of a shotgun approach, yeah. Especially with those smaller farms. And I know that's some of the challenge. And FDA recognizes this as well. And they did a series of listening sessions a few years ago. And one of the things that came out was, especially for the smaller farms, it becomes even more challenging because they don't have a veterinarian on staff, or they don't have somebody who comes out. Like for a dairy farm, you know, you typically have those routine herd checks.
Yeah.
So that you're just on that veterinarian schedule. And obviously, if you have things in between, you already have that veterinary client patient relationship.
Yeah.
But you don't have that. It's not like if somebody calls me up on Christmas Eve and has a problem, I can't necessarily, if I've never seen them before, never been on their farm, I don't have the ability to just say, hey, stop by and pick up this medicine. I can't do that because legally I don't have that veterinary client patient relationship. And so that makes it hard as well. Your heart wants to help them, but you can't necessarily do it in that way because of the laws, and we don't want to, and we also want to make sure it's safe for the animal and, you know, and eventually the food too.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that made sense.
No, it does.
But
I just wanted to highlight it because I just want to highlight it because I feel like, you know, I was an animal science minor at Ohio State, and I saw a lot of people going through their animal science degree to potentially be vets.
Yes.
And honestly, like, you can tell the ones that were like, hey, they're going to be companion animal vets. And it was an overwhelming majority of those kids. So it's like, it's just something that it's a little closer to my heart because I just know how pivotal that role is in our food system.
Well, also think about the number of students in college that, you know, less than 2% of us, right, in the U.S. are involved directly with agriculture. And when you're talking about animal agriculture, that number is even smaller. So think about even the number of kids that have never been exposed to an animal that weighs more than they do.
Yeah.
And so that's a little bit overwhelming. Not for everyone. You know, there are folks, I didn't grow up on a farm.
Yeah.
I love agriculture, been around it all my life, but didn't grow up on a farm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is the possibility to, you know, to jump into agriculture, but if it's not known to them, you know, that makes it a little bit harder. And that's why I love the animal sciences program, because they do get some exposure and kind of get to try some things. Hey, do I like pigs?
Yeah.
Do I like sheep? Do I like poultry? It gives them at least some exposure to something other than cats and dogs, which is probably the main thing that they'd been around. Now, there are certainly food animal folks like yourself in that animal sciences program, and I think that's great. But I think we do need to, you know, kind of do some hand-holding. And I think Ohio State is doing that with some of the folks that are interested in more of the large animal veterinary medicine, because we do need more of those brilliant minds coming to replace old people like me.
Well, when you see so much cool stuff, right? I mean, even stuff we did on our pig farm, we're like, I like was on like my uncle was a vet, and like I was literally a parrot on his shoulder watching like C-sections and, you know, like, you know, even just like lancing stuff, and, you know, all that stuff is like so cool to me. So I mean, like, you get
You're
to see some cool.
Jordan.
I know.
I like that.
A little
That's
bit,
why we get along.
A little bit. I pulled stuff out of pigs that, you know, don't
want to
think about anymore. But so speaking of that, I don't know if you are like this in your family, but one of the always things that always intrigued me about having a vet in the family is, like, he was considered like the doctor of the family. So like stitches got taken out or maybe put in, super glued of things. We may or may not have got amoxicillin, you know, from certain non-doctor prescribed areas. So, what kind of?
Oh, never do such a thing. What do you mean?
Are you like the country doctor in your family too? You're like, hey,
bit.
Like my uncle, like, I think your thumb is not broken. Let me pull on it.
Yeah.
2 days later, it's still blue, and my mom had to take me to the hospital. It's still broken. Thanks, vet uncle, who is not a medical doctor.
Why didn't he X-ray it?
Because he didn't. Because he pulled on it and said it was fine. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, I do have to admit to X-raying my husband, but I have some rules. The rule was, and this is when I was still in companion animal practice, he had fallen and cracked his ankle on the ice. And I'm like, come in, I'll at least X-ray it, right? So I took a couple shots. But before I X-rayed it, I looked him in the eye and I said, okay, I have some rules. And he's like, all right. I said, there will be no biting, no kicking, no pooping and peeing on
and
the
table.
He was
like, just scratch my belly and we'll be fine. And did you take it and be like, this is going to have to come off? Like, we're going to have to take this off?
You know what? That is the joke with my kids. Whenever they got hurt, and if you ask them to this day what I'm going to say when they get hurt, my answer is always, let's amputate. And then they'd always laugh, and now they just roll their eyes since they're older now. So, you know what? Am I the country doctor? Maybe a little. Yeah. I have a niece who's a nurse practitioner, so, you know, it's really nice to be able to call her up on those kinds of things. I do have to admit that when I was in practice, I had kind of a old country doctor for my MD, for my family. And so literally I would call him up and say, hey, I got this going on. Or, you know, there were times I've done a urinalysis on myself. Is that too much information? But it's no different than a dog, right?
It's not.
So I can see what's going on, and I'd report it to my doctor, and he's like, hey, you got this on your shelf? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, Take this dose. And so literally he would write it down.
We're just talking off-label medicine here. It's no big deal.
No, it wasn't lost. It was actually a human medication.
Different than I would go
to the pharmacy. It's the exact same thing. And I'm like, yeah, we have that. And he's like, all right, take this dose for this amount of time. And if it doesn't get better, come see me. We'll culture it. I'm like, cool.
Well, we affectionately called the brown bottle of amoxicillin in our fridge goat medicine. So that was our affectionate name for ourselves.
Okay, I have one other funny story about that. And that is, okay, so I was singing in this community choir and I had this coolest solo ever. And 2 days before we're going to do the performance, and we'd been practicing for like 2 months, 2 days before I get strep throat, or at least I think I have strep throat, I go to the doctor, and normally I horse around with that, right? That's probably a bad thing to say, horse around. Anyway, I horse around, delay it, right? Because I'm going to be fine. I'll get better. But this was one of those times I'm like, I'm going to get in. I'm so worried I'm not going to be able to do this really coolest solo ever thing. So I went into the doctor, and they cultured, you know, they did that quick test, right? And said, you have strep throat. And he starts writing a prescription. And I go, what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm writing you a prescription for a penicillin derivative. I'm writing you this prescription. And I go, oh, no. I don't want a prescription, because I knew that if I took that, I mean, I'd had that before and it like takes you a while
to work.
And so I said, no, I want the injection.
You're going to say, get the needle out?
Yeah. I'm like, no, I want an injection. And he gave me this horrified look. And he's like, well, we don't normally do that, especially in adults. And I said, here's the deal.
Yeah.
I said, you're either going to give it to me here, which I would much prefer, because man, does it sting. I know why cows kick when you give it to them. Man, does it sting. But I said, two choices. You can either give it to me while I'm here, much preferred, or you can give me the dose and I'm going to go home and give it to myself. And he looks at me and he goes, you're serious, aren't you? And I go, I am dead dog serious. So you decide. I'd rather do it here and have you do it than me try and stick it in my rear end myself. And so they did it, and the nurse was truly nervous.
But I
was fine. I got to do my solo.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I guess I'm really allergic to poison ivy. And so I've had the same experience where I go in the doctor and it's like, I've had plenty of shots. And so now I'm like, I go in the doctor and say, okay, I have poison ivy in my face. I need the shot in the butt. And the guy's like, I think when you request certain things, they're more likely to not give it to you.
Yeah, probably.
So, so sometimes I do win and I get it because I just want to, you know, cut to the chase. Somebody my size, I mean, I'm 6'4", 280, and it's like, yes, that's what the male nurse wanted to do that morning was, you know, administer the poison ivy shot. So.
And I am not giving my height and weight. I'm just telling you.
I'm just trying to get, I mean, if people don't know me, they can see that I have a big shadow. So we'll transition to that too. We'll wrap up with, what's the future of, like, the animal medical world or the medicinal world? So, are we going to move that, like, really precise prescriptions to like mobile units, or like what is the future, do you think, of how we are administering, you know, antibiotics and other medications for our livestock?
I think we are in a mode of continuous improvement. You know, we're always trying to do a better job for our animals in lots of different ways. And a lot of the ways I talked about, whether it's housing, whether it's Nutrition we're getting so much better at as well. Even using some of these nutritional specialty products that help us reduce the need for other medications like antibiotics. Vaccinations, we're getting better at those. You know, all of those things I think are really, really important. I don't foresee a world without antibiotics, and I think that's really important. Antibiotics are not bad. We want to use them responsibly. That is extraordinarily important, that we're using them when we need them, in the right circumstances. And I just think that is really, really key, because we want them to work both for humans and animals when we need the most. So we do need to continue to get better at diagnosis and using these medications appropriately. So I think what I foresee in the future are several things. I think we're going to continue to find more, as I called, nutritional specialty products. I think we're going to see more things like that that do work. They have efficacy. Some people like to call it frou-frou dust. Mm-hmm. And no, there are actually some things that work out there. I think we're going to see more in vaccines and vaccine technology. I think we're going to continue to see more on gene editing. I think that's a fascinating opportunity. And it's fascinating because we now are beginning to recognize the potential in disease prevention. You know, if we can make pigs that are PRRS resistant, mm-hmm. Porcine respiratory and reproductive syndrome. So it's a disease of pigs that is devastating, both economically, but also can be to the animal as well.
So, and it carries, and it hangs around, right?
It does.
Can be carriers, or
it's a virus, and so it's one of those diseases that has some pretty big economic considerations for the entire pork industry. So if we can reduce the incidence of that disease by producing animals that are resistant with no medication, no vaccination, none of that, that's spectacular. I think that helps us. And obviously PRRS is a virus, but also remember that oftentimes viruses will immunosuppress. It'll mess up the immune system and allow those secondary bacterial infections that an animal normally would fight off to kind of creep in. And then lots of times you kind of get a co-infection, if you will.
Yep.
So it's those kinds of things that I really see coming. I think we're going to see some additional tools in our toolbox, but I think it's extraordinarily important that we maintain the use of antibiotics for prevention, control, and treatment.
All right. Well, I think that's all I got. Hopefully, everyone enjoyed our personal stories and where we've had medicine administered.
Did we share too much?
Maybe, but I appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks, Jordan.
And that was Dr. Leah Dorman with Phibro Animal Health. If you want to know more about what Dr. Dorman is talking about and some of the things that she's working on, please visit exploreanimalhealth.org. If you have any questions for me or any topics you'd like to suggest, my email is johoewischer.org. So just throw me an email and I'd be happy to talk to you. And if you would please rate and subscribe to the podcast, that really helps drive numbers for us and understand who's listening and where you're listening from and kind of what you think about the podcast. So really appreciate it. Thank you.